episode 3, Fathers and Sons, and the 4th episode, The Diary, are over. But we are just getting started over here on Post Show Recaps. I'm Mary Kwiatkowski, here with Sarah Carradine, who I think I could trust to at least roll up the window when there are important documents stashed inside the car.
Mary, I know where you live, and I have friends everywhere.
Okay, yes, please don't come after me. There's been too much of that.
Not even in your dreams. But yes, I promise I will roll up the window, preserving the very important ancient artifact inside the VW van, which, as we're going to find out, has not suffered at all from sitting for 6 weeks in a swampy impound lot.
No,
doesn't even need
not.
Petrol.
Yeah, and this is why, of course, you should always copy everything in triplicate. Come on, everybody, don't just make one copy of the historic artifact. Everybody gets a copy. Yes, we are recapping Outer Banks season 3 with full spoilers. We're doing 2 episodes at a time. We already covered episode 1 and 2, so if for some reason you're seeing this first, go back and check out episode 1 and 2, and then come join us for each of the next 2 episodes. Obviously, you can subscribe to the feed so you don't miss a minute of our coverage, postshowrecaps.com/binge. And if you have a moment to rate and review, it makes a huge difference over there. All right. Well, these 2 episodes were, I'm not going to say a downslide, but they were not quite as exciting as the first 2, I think. I think the first 2 we talked about, it was go, 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 very little time for rest, all adrenaline. And these 2, there was action, but it feels like more like one sort of big episode.
Yeah, it's a lot of chess pieces. We've got to get everybody from wherever they are back to the Outer Banks. So we are told how each of them gets there, which is fine. I'm very happy to go with them. But there's a lot of people moving about from place to place and how they actually get there. So, yeah, I was happy to sit and watch these, a little bit of place setting. But I'm hoping for a slight uptick in the running around and crashing things that we've come used to in the next 2. We shall have to see.
Yes. I think the show is not called Barbados and Guadeloupe for a reason. We have to get back to the Outer Banks.
And we're just stopping at St. Kitts.
Right. And I did like the trekking around in the boats, and I do appreciate the show making sure that we know, like, at different times we need to get clothes, we need to get food. I don't think we mentioned it last time, but one of my favorite lines was when they were running away from Jimmy's house saying, "We took some of your clothes," and they just run off with bags of clothes. Like, I appreciate that. You've been living on a deserted island for a month. Surprised your clothing is that intact to begin with. But this, as we left off from the episode 2, John B. heard the bells and was running up to the church on the hill. And we had a little bit of a suspenseful cliffhanger. Is he going to go inside? Is anyone else going to be there?
You were worried that it was going to be the trope of Big John just leaving just before John B. arrived, and they almost did it. They faked us out, but no, of course not.
I'm actually surprised that we didn't get another trope, which is he gets there, he sees his dad, but then he sees his dad talking to Carla Limbrey and is like, what's going on? Maybe my dad's not who I thought he was. Maybe I should, no. Happy, pretty quick reunion, first couple minutes. We get the Johns back together, and it divulges pretty quickly in these 2 episodes of maybe now John B. realizes his father was not quite who he sort of stacked him up to be. I think, you know, the first 2 seasons of having this lost father, clearly a great figure in John B.'s life, but was obsessed with this treasure hunt. And now we see its obsession to the point of carelessness and endangering himself, his son, asking his son to do crimes in the name of treasure hunting, that sort of thing. So I guess, was it a letdown for you to see who Big John really is, or...
Oh, no, I really liked it because he'd been set up as this perfect father. I mean, we have imperfect fathers, Ward Cameron, very imperfect father, JJ's father, very imperfect father. And then we have Kiara and Pope's fathers and mothers, you know, good, solid citizens, but not necessarily adored in the same way that John B. adores his father. He does say we solved the mother situation in a quick voiceover. My mother left when I was three, so she's still alive.
Yeah.
Presumably. Yeah. But I really
that's
liked
not season four fodder.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. My heart did sink a little bit. I thought, oh, don't bring her back for a season four because we want it done. But no, I liked Big John being a real person. And I like the markers of addiction that they've given him in terms of this treasure hunt. You know, this sort of almost ruthlessness, a blinkeredness. Yes, he loves his son, but there's a detachment from people around him because of this treasure hunt. I mean, he's about to make a pit stop to see the man that saved his life, and he doesn't deal with him in a very good way. So almost straight away we start to see the scales falling off John B's eyes as far as his father goes. And I like that. And that's also part of the theme of the growing up, the theme of these teenagers stepping into their real selves. And one of the things that you have to do as a teen becoming a young adult is, you know, kill your parents, divorce your parents, you know, step away from seeing them through to children's eyes and see them as another adult. So I really liked that.
I think it's interesting, especially when you compare John B's relationship to Big John to the other father and son pairs in the show, which is the title of the episode, because you have someone like Rafe, who's just so dedicated to wanting his father's approval. And it doesn't seem like John B really wants his father's approval. Instead, John B is able to look at his father and see the areas where he would act differently. I think when we get to the scene in the antique shop, if that was John B and someone who had saved his life and that he, you know, or one of his friends, he would have gone back for them. I mean, we saw Kiara go back and save Jimmy on the boat, even though she probably shouldn't have and didn't turn out so great for her. So I think just the way that having a support system of friends, even if it's the chaotic pogues around mm-hmm. you, has given John B this like stick together all for one kind of attitude that seems like Big John doesn't quite have. He's more of a he's obsessed with the treasure hunt. I tweeted out that this show is like National Treasure in bathing
yes.
suits.
Yes.
And I just kept thinking of the scene in the first National Treasure movie where I can't remember any of the characters' names, but you know, where the main character goes to his father's house and brings the girl, and his father is yelling at him about you know, I was obsessed with this. My father was obsessed with this. Now you're obsessed with this treasure hunt. It can't end well. And I think Big John is just in too deep where he's like, well, we've already risked all of this. Let's just keep risking it. And I think if it was me, I would think, you know what, after like one or two close saves with the death, maybe just go home and get a day job.
Yeah, yes, it's the sunk cost fallacy. You know, yeah. we have come thus far and we cannot go back, but in fact it might be time to step away. But let's see, we're just at the beginning of the adventure, but I suspect that we're going to see more of Big John, you know, being a mere mortal with feet of clay in John B's eyes.
Let me ask you this, up top. Do you think by the end of this season that Big John is going to die?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't asked myself that question.
Whether in pursuit of the treasure or
yes.
to save John B's life in some
yes.
pivotal way.
As a sort of redemptive mm-hmm. moment. Yes, as you say, he does not go back for the man who saved his life here at the antiquities shop. I think that's intriguing and I like it. It's very satisfying narratively. And it is, you know, the final step for John B to step into his adulthood is to would be to lose his father. And depending on what happens with this treasure hunt and how far John, Big John's prepared to go, it might be that, you know, it's a shorthand for the only way that he can redeem himself. And especially if it was saving John B. So, oh, I think that's intriguing. Mark that down as a prediction.
I agree. I think that it might happen. And I think generally if you think someone is dead and they come back to life, it's usually not for a just complete happy ending where everybody ends up together.
Yeah. Yes.
At the end. So we'll see.
Speaking of people who've been dead.
Right. Speaking of other fathers and sons, over in Guadalupe, Ward does wake up. He gets out of his coma, and Rose and Wheezy are there. Rafe is not, because as we know, Rafe is still stuck in Barbados after he got pushed off his boat. But the others are there. And so I guess that first question we had in the previous episode, Ward is not getting completely written out of the show, at least yet. He's appears to be coming back. So definitely not as big of a character so far in these first four episodes as he was in the previous seasons, but glad to see that he'll at least be still a presence.
Yes. And in this moving of everybody except, you know, the Camerons to the Outer Banks, I wonder if that's whether it's going to be phone calls from Ward and maybe is this the only glimpse of Wheezy, who I remember us liking very much in the first two seasons, the younger sister who had a lot of gumption. I hope this isn't all that we see of her. But it might be that Ward, because they think he's dead back in the Outer Banks, maybe Ward stays here on Guadalupe and we receive him, you know, via phone calls to Rafe and, you know, perhaps Sarah, depending on what happens. I'm just not sure how he fits, like what's his current motivation. I mean, he's only just woken up from his coma of convenience, so I suppose we should give him a chance to come up with a scheme.
Did we ever find out what Wheezy's real name is? That can't
well,
be
it has to.
Name.
It has to be Louise.
Oh, okay. That there you go. I had never thought about that.
Oh yeah.
It was just what's a W girl's name?
Okay. I imagine it's Louise.
Oh. Okay, there you go. And but you know, there's so many people in the show, like, is Topper his real name? I don't know.
Yeah, it's T O P H E R.
Well, that's Topher.
Well, it is, but maybe it's not. I just assumed. I mean, in my notes, I write it Topper because it's easier than putting the H in. But
I don't know. When I use I'm a closed caption gal, and it usually just says Topper.
Okay.
So I don't know.
There you go. All right.
But it could be a nickname for Topher or something like that. I'm not sure.
Yes.
Maybe he's
a top. Who knows?
probably. And although, I don't know. These next few episodes haven't necessarily shown that. And I don't know also if we know where the Mrs. Cameron was. Did she die? Was she just out of the picture? It's an interesting idea for the show to want to have the Rose character and not
yes.
just and not just their mother. It's almost like they feel like, well, having a mother who is going to be privy to the actions that Rafe and Ward have taken against Sarah would be a little hard to probably write into the show. So they need another person there who's a partner to Ward, but not going to have that same parental feeling towards Sarah.
Yes. I mean, I like the selection of her. Her age is interesting because she's sort of between Sarah and Ward's age. And we imagine, I mean, Gold Digger is rude. She may have come with her own money for all we know, but she certainly is in on all the schemes. I don't know if we know where their mother is. There's a bit of convenient writing out of parents, either or both, for some of these characters, which is a real trope back from, I mean, I think of the adventure stories from the 40s and 50s that I read in my childhood in the 60s and 70s and early 70s. And the first thing you do is you get rid of the parents.
Oh, yeah.
You know, send them on a trip, or they die or something, and you have to go and stay with an uncle you've never met before, or you're left to your own devices. And with this sort of overarching theme of the Pogues running all over the Outer Banks, and with a carefree sort of barefoot, unwashed lifestyle. Parents are only going to be interferences, I think. And certainly Josh and Jonas Pate, the creators, along with Shannon Burke, they talk about their childhood there, being, minus the adventure and all the killings one assumes, being one of this very sort of loose, running all day, surfing, swimming, boating lifestyle that they wanted to recreate. And I really love it. It rings so true. And we said this about seasons one and two, and I'm struck again of how in a heightened teenage love, teenage hormone-fueled story, with the addition of sort of big bads in the adult world and the addition of these mysterious treasures and hunting and all of that, it's wonderful how well it rings true, certainly to me, watching them. And as you say, they don't just suddenly have new clothes. They have come from somewhere. You know, they steal them from Jimmy, or they're all about to go home and get new clothes, except poor old JJ.
It's interesting when I compare this to other sort of teen drama adventure or murder mystery teen shows. And some things that really work for Outer Banks are that it somehow feels realistic while also being fantastical. Like, most people, like you're saying, are not going to be skipping school and having all these near-death experiences and dealing with gold and mythical treasure. But they are, since it's filmed maybe not in the Outer Banks but on some location, you're able to get the realism of the atmosphere, like we said, the clothing, the need, the discussion of need for food. The first thing I ever noticed watching season one was the fact that they don't shy away from the characters being dirty and gross and sweaty and tired and hungry and that sort of thing, which I appreciate. It's sort of like this hybrid of watching, you know, Survivor and watching a scripted show. And then on top of that, the fact that it is a 10 episode series allows them to have much more concise plots that don't create, in teen dramas, you can run into this problem of, okay, the bad guy, the big bad, it needs to be an adult because otherwise it's not serious enough. But then why is an adult dealing with children? Why is the adult so afraid, or, you know, how are these meddling kids really stacking up? And how is, you know, you have to have this idea of at some point they need to be taken down. And so it can't just be 22 episodes for 7 seasons fighting against the same bad guy. So I think that's all things that work well for Outer Banks here. But yes, anyway,
and that's certainly, there were two teenage bads. Topper redeemed himself, but Rafe continues to be a little bad and a very unpleasant fellow.
Yeah, another thing I have is, in movies and TV shows, I always feel so bad for the, like, side characters who just get swindled by the plot. Like, so Rafe is going to target this American tourist and mug him, and that makes me feel so bad. And then later on with the shopkeeper in St. Kitts, I'm like, no, I feel so bad for the these just people minding their own business.
they didn't know they were in the middle of a big budget Netflix series. Just going about their business. Yes, Rafe has to mug him to get his straw hat and his wallet so he can get the ferry to
Guadeloupe. Why did he need to
take
the hat?
Or to disguise his face, I suppose. But there is a ferry, because when I looked up for our last episode, when I looked up the distance from Guadeloupe to Barbados and found it was 404 kilometres, it also gave me the ferry timetable. So that is the actual ferry. I thought, oh, research, there we go. That's how he got back where he was going.
It's good that you caught that was a ferry. I thought for a second it was a cruise ship, and I was thinking, now there's no way that whatever was in that one wallet was enough identification to get on a cruise ship.
Yeah,
but a ferry makes way more sense.
Yeah, I thought it was a cruise ship at first, and then I thought, oh, that's right. Yes, of course, it's the ferry that my very brief research, you know, turned up. The Pogues have set off to sea again in a boat where you think, I think we said this about the first two seasons, and then we realized you can, it's a straight shot. You can actually do it in a, it doesn't have to be a substantial boat to get from Barbados to where they're going. What did you think of Kiara and JJ getting a little bit steamy and Pope seeing it and being a bit sad? Because I thought we were done with the Pope-Kiara liaison, and they have had a month on an island, so I wasn't
yeah.
sure.
I thought we were also done with the Pope thing. I thought at the very least, that was something we were going to move on from. But at this point, early on in season one, there was a rule, no pogue on pogue action. And Kiara has now had at least some sort of action with every pogue male. So good for her.
Yes.
They're really not paying attention to that one rule. I feel bad for Pope, but I find him to be a difficult character to really identify with, because I'm much more on Cleo's side with all her arguments about, you know, Pope, you think you have this very difficult life. This show is sort of a representation of various extreme different levels of privilege, right? And there's obviously people like Ward and the Camerons and Topper and the other kooks who have, you know, amassed a certain level of wealth, that it's going to be way more difficult to sympathize with someone like Rafe when he says he's a victim when, excuse me, look what you have. And then you compare that to people like John B., who had a roof over his head, at least some parental, you know, guardianship for a while, some level of right or wrong. Pope, who's got also had a job and two parents and a house, and then down to JJ, and then down to Cleo, who's been living presumably, you know, more or less on her own, more or less homeless for most of her life. And when she hears that Pope has a family and a house and a bedroom and a scholarship, she's like, what in the world are you chasing gold for? So
exactly,
you know, and I know that this is not exactly the same as his issues with Kiara and love and all of that, but I just have a hard time sympathizing with him when he's kind of woe is me, when I'm like, you've got something, you know?
Yeah. And I also, I suppose I was a little, I thought, yeah, we had this storyline and we finished this storyline. Mm-hmm. I think he could observe it. And in his observing it and them seeing him observe it, then they realize, oh, yes, there was something, because they don't actually kiss, but they have this little moment. So quite like the triangle. But then him being sad and her having to talk to him about it and all of that, I thought, oh, I feel like we're going backwards. But unless that was setting up Pope and Cleo, I'm not sure that they are going to swear on a no love club, including a very special handshake to signify.
And, you know, despite everything I just said about Pope, I remember when I was a teenager, and if one of my friends started making moves on someone that I liked, it would have been gut-wrenching, and I would have felt massively betrayed by all parties, even if I knew that I wasn't going to be with that person. It still would have felt hard. So I get the feeling, you know, you gotta have moody teenagers.
Moody teenage. So I very much hope that Kiara and JJ are not related, if they're going to go.
I don't think they are.
Yes, I don't think they are. Because I feel they are going to go down this alleyway, as we suspected that they might.
Yep. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So Rafe does pretty easily make it back to Ward's bedside, and they have a quick chat where Ward wants to send Rafe back to the Outer Banks, because, you know, we can't just have the Pogues go back to Outer Banks. We need to have everybody go back at the same time. And he wants everything to sort of be wrapped up with his affairs, to sell the business, sell the rental properties, and sell their house in Tanny Hill, which Rafe is not really on board with, but, you know, still wants to appease his father and show that he can handle some things. Now, what do you feel about the logistics of Ward has died?
Yes.
But for the last month, his house is like, everybody escaped. Where has where has the world thought that Rafe and Rose and Wheezy were for the last month? I'm a little confused on these details.
Yeah, potentially on Guadalupe. I mean, they know that they have a house there. And part of the planning of their nefarious plans with Sarah and Gold and the Cross might have been to say, oh, because Ward has died, we're going to go into, I'm making this up now, a bit of fan fiction, but you know that we're going to go to our house on Guadalupe. So that's where they may think that they've been. They would have some employees who would keep the house going, and presumably, Ward's estate has passed to Rose? Rafe? Rafe may have a power of attorney. I don't need to be have every step of the way with them, but I wonder if once they get back onto the Outer Banks, we're going to once Rafe gets back onto the Outer Banks and starts these business dealings, whether we're going to get a little bit more on that, or whether it's just one of those things that you just have to kind of jump onto the jet ski and hang on for dear life and not ask too many questions. What's your thoughts there? Where do you think they are?
Yeah, that's a good idea, good premise. I couldn't remember if from the previous season if there was any sort of announcement of Rose telling the public that where they were going or that they were leaving. I can't remember. But it's an interesting thought of the complications that Ward might face with faking his own death and then realizing that, legally and economically, he doesn't necessarily, he can't both be dead and have power over his money. Unless he's doing a lot of complicated creating a new identity and transferring funds and all that, which he could do. But if things are sort of following through the normal procedures, Rose or more likely Rafe and potentially even Sarah probably own everything he had legally if he was actually dead. So
yeah, I think including that's his debts, because we know he's disgraced. So yeah, because you inherit people's debts as well. Oh, do you in the US, do you inherit people's debts?
Oh, I think, I'm not an expert on that, but I think to some extent you probably do. I think it sort of depends if you're, you can't just take their assets and not their debts. So I think there's sort of a one or the other there.
Yes.
But yeah, it's definitely, I think the main thing that we should keep an eye out for is how this may come back to bite Ward, or is he going to resurrect himself somehow? But I believe that he was the reason he faked his death was because he was a out and out criminal, and that he was going suspect, to be taken in
suspect in the death of, or an accessory to the death of the sheriff.
I believe so. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think there was a bit of season two hubbub with the new. Well, I don't know if they're the new police chief or a deputy of some sort, who thought that John B. was the one who had killed Peterkin, but he eventually finds out that that's not the case and that it was the Camerons. So
yes, and the marvelous scene of Barry, the lowdown drug dealer, right. turned police informant in yes. that scene where he jumps out of the boat into the alligator filled water, to saying he's got a gun. I do remember that, and I liked that because I like Barry very much, and his even though he's a drug dealer,
I like the worst character.
Well, I mean, like,
I can't stand Barry.
But in terms of them being written in a particular way, and from my memory, Barry was interesting because he was a drug dealer, but it was all very straightforward and businesslike. He yes. wasn't like creepy. He wasn't like evil for the sake of it. He wasn't cackling maniacally as his henchmen beat people up. It's like, I sell you drugs and you give me money. It's really straightforward. So that, when I say I liked him, I mean I liked the way he was written very economically. And so while we were surprised when he turned on Rafe, we could actually see why. Like, that was an earned moment. So, yes.
Maybe that's another reason I've been liking Rafe a little more this season, is that he's, at least we're not having to deal with him being high on drugs, and also his his built-in personality at the same time. I don't think those were feeding each other well.
No, he comes with that personality.
Yeah, yeah. Goodness. Yeah, so anything else? Let's see. They all arrive back in the Outer Banks. Yes, the Johns, John B and Big John, both go to back to their house, which I'm also pretty surprised is not worse for wear. It hasn't been ransacked. There's no one squatting in it. There's no eviction notice. The electricity was turned off, but that's about it. So they still have their property. Maybe it's been paid off. I don't know. Maybe they don't have a mortgage payment.
Maybe a kindly neighbor has been checking them, walking the perimeter and checking the property.
Maybe, yeah.
But mind you, both of them are dead as far as everyone. No, they know that John B is alive because he returned from the dead and went back to school rather spectacularly in season two. So the Johns arrive home and Big John immediately wants to know where the diary is. So this is, we start to get this inkling of his obsession.
Yes. Presumably that we sort of skipped over some of the big plot of the break into the antique store and taking the totem that was there. So presumably on the boat, on their trip back to the Outer Banks, they've each filled each other in on all of the goings on of what their treasure hunt plan. John B's probably said, yes, we had the diary. We had a copy of it at least. And the artifact that they have is, as Big John calls it, the signpost of Orinoco, I think.
Yes. The MacGuffin of MacGuffin. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. It's the top half of the full signpost. It's sort of a stone figure, and he thinks that you need to find the other half in order to get directions to find El Dorado. So we're full in on El Dorado, and of course, Carlos Singh had popped up at the antique store once again. It's like if he has this many goons to surround an armed compound, when you go and you think that have almost caught a person, you don't bring all your goons inside. You surround the store first before you go in. Make sure you've checked all the exits. And instead, John B and Big John are able to escape out the window and
making a huge amount of noise.
Yeah, and do we think that the man, I believe Arjun, who worked at this store, do you believe that he was killed in that action as well? The person who apparently was the one who saved Big John?
I believe so. We didn't get enough of him for him to return from the dead, I don't think, sadly for him. He and Jimmy are, raising a glass in Valhalla.
Yes. And I can't remember if it's in this episode or the next episode where we get the full backstory of Big John. Is that the next episode? I'm trying to remember.
We do get them exchanging information on the boat trip, which I thought was a good use of the boat trip. They had time on the boat to fill each other in. And while we didn't hear each of them tell the other absolutely everything, we now just assume that each knows everything about the other.
Yeah, and the piece that I found interesting was that, last we saw Big John had washed ashore the shoals, and that later they found a skeleton there. But really he was sort of kidnapped by Carlos from that, from his spit, and was serving as his archaeologist essentially.
Yes, yes.
Analyzing the artifacts. And so this is a confusing bit that I'm still not 100% sure on, that we knew in the first two seasons that not only Big John was interested in this treasure hunt, but had some sort of academic background in treasure hunting, archaeology, ancient history, something in that realm.
It's so far unclear, I would say. The other thing that is unclear is that Big John escaped from Carlos's place in Vauxhall.
Yes.
But somehow. Why didn't Carlos just go and get him?
Right.
He's been hiding out with Limbury, I understand, but surely Carlos has eyes everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of rewriting that's a little confusing. When Limbury shows up at the end of season two, it appears that Big John is only barely hanging on, sitting on a porch, you know, wrapped up and as if he's just been rescued from the island, when it turns out actually he was rescued a while ago, worked for Carlos for a while, and then escaped. Yes. There.
So, maybe working for Carlos diminishes a man.
maybe. So anyway, but yeah, they're all back in Outer Banks, and got a couple sequences of nightmares from John B., worried that Carlos has caught up to them and is attacking his father. But when he wakes up, alas, or not alas, but happily, it is Sarah who is the one there waking him. But Big John has disappeared. Dun, dun, dun. And on that note, we're going to pop out for a quick second. I think I see a box of Twinkies over in the corner. So I'm going to go snack on a few of those. And then we'll come back and talk about the next episode. All right. We are back. And I don't know about yum, you, Sarah. Yum. I can only stomach about one Twinkie every few years. They're a little rich for my blood, but
they were a little damp. I don't know if
a little damp. Was yours sitting out in the rain?
I think mine was sitting out in the rain. That's right.
Oh my gosh. So the previous episode, of course, ends on this slight cliffhanger, but I wasn't really at all surprised. I was like, okay, he's probably just gone to go get the diary.
Yes, it was a very odd thing of John B. telling Sarah that Big John was back and them looking and he's not in the house, and she wonders if he's gone mad because, of course, Big John is dead.
But how else would John B. have gotten back to the Outer Banks?
Exactly. I thought it was unnecessary because it doesn't go anywhere because Big John arrives. So I thought, come on. Come on.
Trying to add a little suspense where there probably isn't any. Because, yes, Big John comes back almost immediately with the Twinkie that, like you said, still works. Apparently still had some some gas in it. I don't know. It's there. It's back. It hasn't completely rusted and fallen apart. So they get that back. And hugs all around. Everything's great. Everybody, a lot of homecomings. Everyone's
yes, I liked this. It wasn't quite a montage because each moment was given its due, but it was there, as we said, at the end of season two when we saw, for example, Kiara's parents putting up the missing persons poster and so on. It's everybody having a homecoming to the people that have been waiting for them, and then ending with JJ finding his house he's been evicted. There's police tape on it, and it's in a very sorry state.
And I'm trying to remember, what state exactly did we leave his father in? Was he dead? What was the situation?
No, he got money for his father, put his father in a car. He and Kiara drove his father to the border, drove his father somewhere, and sort of sent him off for a new life. Please don't ever return.
Okay, that's right. Well, that's good at least. Then honestly, JJ should not be surprised that his house is in the state that it is, knowing that no one's been living there. Pope brings Cleo home, and I don't know if it's exactly chivalry, because I think Pope's mom is the one who makes him give up his room for Cleo.
Yes, I love Pope. Pope's mother is a queen, and she would have been very strict about, yes, she gets the bedroom.
I love Pope's family. Pope's dad is my favorite character on the entire show. What I also love about his family is that, unlike the first season, Pope has clued his family into everything that's going on. He's told them about the cross. They know it. They know about their inheritance and their ancestry. And so while they, of course, would prefer probably Pope to go to school, have not left, have his scholarship and all that, I think they at least it's not like they're just Pope is constantly lying to them. He's told them what's going on, and I think that helps. Sort of similarly in Kiara's household, her parents, especially her mother, you know, I think was just so desperate to get her back that she is a bit more willing to give Kiara a little bit of a longer leash. Since the short one clearly wasn't what kept Kiara around. So,
yes, exactly. Exactly. You
know, and I kind of go back and forth because her father, on the other hand, is like, no, she's a child. She's living under our roof. You know, we need to make sure that she's doing the right thing.
It's interesting, and I hadn't really put that together, but yes, I do like that Pope has filled his family in on. There's the, you know, introduction of Cleo. We get a little of her story. She's never had a room of her own. So again, she's probably wondering, what on earth do you have to complain about? And we are about to get sort of more class stuff when Kiara goes to visit JJ. Kiara, of course, is a kook who wants to be a pogue. So above JJ, and Cleo looks at Pope's family and thinks that he's rich beyond measure, not just in money, not even in money, but in the family unit, right, and the love that she sees there. And I really like seeing that through her sort of very frank eyes. She's seen a lot, and this is a joy to her to be in this family, or to be, you know, introduced to this family.
Yeah, Pope's family should just adopt her, and
yes,
I think that would be great.
Yes, I agree.
and yeah, we have some. Sarah's also going to go back to her house, which I again appreciate the going to get supplies. Although I really can't look past, look, I understand they're supposed to be teenagers and all of that, but I can't look past the fact that even when these teenagers wake up, assuming that they're going to be doing, you know, heists or running around or, you know, running from people committing crimes, they're still in their shortest of shorts and barely held together shirts. And I'm like, flip-flops, put some substantial clothes on, put some, I want laced tennis shoes. I want like layers, bring a jacket. What if you get stranded on an island again? Like, get cold. Like, I just want them all with a backpack at all times, full of the essentials. Flashlights, batteries, food, matches.
Vitamins, chewable vitamins.
Yes.
Yes. Sarah is putting together a bag of things.
Probably cute outfits and
bathing suits. Cute outfits. Sunglasses. Exactly. But she does linger over her costume jewelry box, and I was saying, Sarah, you do not need any of that. But she was selecting a nice bead or two to go into her bag to go with her cute outfits.
Meanwhile, while all of that's happening, Big John does bring the car home. He's upset about the diary, even though at least it's not the actual artifact that has been ruined, just the paper copy. And this is why you should also put things in, you should laminate, should put them in binders, you know, that would help. Maybe have a nice filing folder with you that you take your important documents. But they,
I'm imagining you on the run in your sensible laced up shoes with a backpack full of the documents filed in an accordion folder.
I am too practical for adventures, so that's okay. But we actually saw this, I think, back in episode one or two. We see the Carlos Singh reading an article about the local history teacher in Kildare who had found this Denmark Tanny's diary. And so Big John and I keep wanting to call him Bobby John, but he's not.
John B.
They go to the history teacher's house where they had gotten the copy, and they find the smugglers who I believe. Now, are these the same people who were on the shipping boat?
Yes.
In season two? Okay.
And yes, they are.
There's so many smugglers. It's hard to keep track because there were separate people in season one who were looking for the treasure. It's complicated. But yeah, they go and they find these smugglers. Thankfully, the history teacher is still alive and seems only mildly beaten up. But they end up chasing after the smugglers because the smugglers stole the diary. It was all very close. It's amazing how quick everybody is on each other's tails. Yes. Like, this could have happened a day before, but no, it happens exactly right when they're going.
Carlos has friends everywhere. We do get a very nice snippet from the smugglers of we take the diary to Carlos and we never have to worry about, import duties at the dock anymore. So, I mean, you're smugglers. I don't know how much you were thinking about import duties before, but Carlos would be a very powerful friend, I think.
Okay, I'm looking at your notes here and I can't mm-hmm. help but notice a particular phrase you used that I have not heard in this. Are you referring to the jet ski?
I am referring to the jet ski.
Okay. This podcast is douche canoe.
I was going to say this podcast is rated clean. I don't know if you can say that. Yes.
I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure it's fine. I have not personally heard. I've only heard that used as an insult and not as a slang term for jet ski, but okay.
Now you have.
Yes. There is a quick chase scene. Big John and Johnny B. What is his name?
John B.
John B. I keep wanting to call him Bobby John. They're trying to just make a deal with the smugglers. Like, we have information you might need. We could work together. This was never going to work. Mostly just for the plot of the show. It would be too complicated to include these smugglers in this deal. So the smugglers are like, yeah, let's just pretend, but then we'll shoot him, the kid in the head. But really quickly, Big John shoots and kills the two men and sinks their boat and they get the diary back. And this was really the turning point for, at the very least, Lil John, when he realized, oh, my father's like a straight up murderer.
Yes. And it doesn't matter how often he says they would have done it to us,
which is true in fly. This case. Well, they would have, but
yes,
it's still
it's the ruthless practicality with which he shoots them both. One is only wounded. He puts the kill shot in the wounded one, pops them over the side, weighted down with anchors, and then opens up something in the boat so that it will sink. And it's all very practiced somehow. There's an air about it that I think is as shocking as the event itself.
It doesn't feel like the first time he's done something mm-hmm. like this. Yes. And I think also, I don't know how much the show might get into it, but John B. has had a complicated relationship with someone like Ward Cameron, who is clearly ruthless and a murderer in his own rights. And seeing that his own father, who he's held in such high regard, is not evil in the same way, but still willing to go to extreme measures for this quest that he's on. And I think, you know, we saw a hint of that when he held a gun on his savior and friend at the antique store, didn't go back to save him. All moves that I don't think John B. would have done.
And the thing is that he didn't need to kill these men. He could have said, the diary is gone forever. We can stop chasing the treasure. So it's not like a situation of self-defense, because he put them in a situation where they were negotiating with ruthless smugglers out in the middle of the water. Somebody was going to get shot. At that point, it's them or us, but you put yourself there, Big John. And I think this is the beginning of John B's seeing his father as a person rather than this idealized figure.
And not only that, but it makes you wonder, was Big John using Limbry to find John B because he missed his son and he wanted to make sure his son was okay? Or is it because he knew his son was on to the treasure and needed his help? At no point has he said, this adventure is too big, you stay home, I'm going to do this, but I want to protect you. I don't think that John B would have necessarily listened to that, but instead it's always been, no, no, son, you're my partner. Come with me. I need your help.
Yes.
And I'm going to put you in these dangerous scenarios. And that's a little hard to swallow.
Yes. Yes. I think that's very insightful and is another kind of layer or another petal of the Big John stinking rose of his obsession. As I said before, I use the word addiction almost to this treasure hunt. He is so far in, he can't even conceive of not continuing. And John B is a piece of the puzzle as much as the signpost is, as much as the diary is, as much as any of these sort of artifacts are.
Right. Exactly. And then we have a different sort of bit of strife between Kiara and JJ as she tries to comfort him. They almost have a sweet moment. They almost kiss again, but instead JJ calls her a kook and once again sort of belittles himself in front of her by, you know, I can understand the idea that he feels like that she's too good for him or that he's worthless. I can understand where he's coming from in those thoughts, but when someone is trying to give their love to you or their friendship or their help, don't push them away. Like it's not ever going to help anything. he just acts like a teenage boy. Well, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. There is that. mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean it's again visually and again using all the tools of a storyteller. Kiara's in a very cute new outfit, you know, that she has access to new clothes. She's clean. She's come down from the figure eight to see him, you know, smelling of money, basically. Last time he saw her, they were sort of filthy together from you know, a month or 6 weeks of running around in danger and closeness. And he is still in the clothes that he was in. He hasn't got new clothes. He hasn't had a shower. So...
And while she has come home and gone back to her family, I think that it was a good reminder that she said to him, you know, I was the one who didn't want to leave. I just lived in a, yes, you know, in a cave with you for a month. Like, yes, that should show you more who I am than, you know, what I'm doing now. But
yes, and calling her a kook is like the worst insult that he can possibly give, yes, her.
Yes. Back in Guadalupe, we've got Ward who, now that he has woken up, he's feeling rightfully horrible about him almost killing Sarah over a cross. And so he decides that he wants to sell the cross, sort of sell/donate the cross to a museum or some other institution in order to atone for his sins, which I can imagine is not going to fly well with Rafe.
Yes, and it doesn't really fly well with Rose until she figures out it'll be a great tax write-off if they do that. So
they have ever so practical. Much gold already. Like, for someone like John, for Big John, who has probably had nothing and feels like he's, you know, just that not only is the treasure a great adventure for him, but, you know, the being the one to discover something and having this light at the end of the tunnel, it's life-changing. For someone like Ward, who already has money, I mean, he's got a safe full of the gold, the merchant gold. He doesn't need the cross. Like, you know, I think sometimes it's like, what is the amount of money that I would be willing, that I would need in order for me to feel like I'm in a different, you know, bucket of life, right? Where I wouldn't have to work again, where I wouldn't, whatever. And it's a certain amount. If you then doubled that, it's not like you get double more lifestyle. You've just, yes, got more excess money. Yes. And so, you know, unless you're planning on starting some sort of institution or like using that money for something, it's not like Ward is going to, he just has more money. What is he going to do? Buy more houses, more boats? Like it just kind of seems ridiculous at this point. So for him, yeah, what's the gold in the cross going to do for him? Why, yes, does Rafe even need this money? He doesn't.
Yes. And it's an artifact. I mean, it's not the worth of the gold. It's an artifact that belongs in a museum. Right. And I think Ward certainly comes from a strata of society that thinks about donating to museums and things being in their proper places. And plus it gives him a feeling of atonement for how he's treated Sarah. Perhaps this is a lingering effect of the coma of convenience. I completely buy this. And also it's taking something away from Rafe.
Right. Right. Which is the worst part. And while Sarah is meanwhile at Tanny Hill at her house packing, she does hear this conversation on the phone. She at least hears Rafe's side of it, hears him being upset about it, saying it's mine, this is my thing. I don't know how Rafe has twisted in his mind that he somehow discovered and found the cross. He just hijacked it from some other people who were discovering it. But okay. But Rafe says, you know, that he can trust him on this, and they get the location. So Sarah overhears the location of when and where the cross is going to arrive on a train.
I wonder if that's going to have an effect on future episodes.
I wonder. More scenes of Pope and Cleo. I just really like Cleo. She's everything that she says is fun. You know, we kind of briefly talked about the scene where she was stealing food from the store when they stopped in St. Kitts, and that was one of my favorite scenes. I mean, I felt so bad for the store owner, but I just love her. Her wiliness is great, because it's, you know, unlike JJ, who has sticky fingers for just sort of, I don't know, for fun. It seems like he's just kind of stealing things when he doesn't need it. She's only stealing when she has to. So
yes, she has a moral code. We love Cleo so much.
Yes. So despite what Rafe said on the phone to Ward, he is not okay with the cross being donated. He feels like it's his thing. And this is some character development, right? He's not just trying to do what his father wants. He's decided, no, this is my thing. I'm going to handle the cross. So what do you think of his plan to work with Barry again, even though they've had a tumultuous history, the two of them?
I mean, it's smart. As he says, they're never going to believe that we would work together because you're the one that betrayed me to the cops. You ratted me out, see? And I was very pleased to see Barry again. Barry wants 50%. Let's see what Barry actually gets. Yeah, it's if you're going to steal the cross, get a criminal to help you. And Barry's the criminal that Rafe knows, ignoring the fact that he himself, of course, is a criminal.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I already said I was not happy to see Barry back.
I know.
We were done with him.
I know.
He causes too many problems.
I love Barry.
Yeah, but they do have a good plan. And so, like you said, I think that's kind of going to be the main part of next episode or the next few is probably going to be dealing with the cross and who's gonna get the cross. So we'll see. We'll see on that one. And then back at the chateau, of course, with the Johns, everybody kind of meets up and talks about what's going on. Around this point also, Big John has told John B, maybe we don't need to fill your friends in on everything. Like, we're happy to give them money when we've got it, you know, once we get the gold. But this is a dangerous game. Now, it's not so dangerous that I'm not going to require your help, John.
Yes.
But but let's just keep your friends out of it. Now, I think this is also plot convenience in a multitude of ways. First off, I have been suspicious about the lack of John B. and Sarah interaction. What about you?
Yes. I asked last episode that you and I spoke for more Sarah or different Sarah, and we've had virtually nothing of her. And again, the plot keeps them all apart as the Johns are in the Twinkie going to exhume a priest in Charleston, having read a very convenient part of the diary that says this priest in Charleston died on the boat and was buried at the only Catholic church there with his effects. It's the very important thing. So he needs to go and dig him up with his effects. So the Johns are separated from the rest of the Pogues, who are making the plan to steal the cross. They briefly wonder where John is, but they're going to go ahead without him.
But here's where I'm suspicious. Now, I don't know if you follow the teen romances in real life, but the actors who played John B and Sarah, I believe, were dating for a time during the filming of, at the very least, season two, but broke up before the filming of season three or sometime during them. And so while I think that everybody is probably, you know, professionals and is happy to work together, I think shows sometimes will separate characters who maybe aren't on the best of terms in real life. And I just can't help but notice the lack of John B and Sarah togetherness. Now, I think it also serves the plot to, you know, it's always going to add tension if Sarah is upset with, you know, John B lying to her and leaving her out. And it adds sort of an interesting, you know, John B was Sarah's link to most of the other Pogues. I know that she had a history with Kiara, but how much are Sarah and JJ really going to talk without John B there?
Exactly.
So
yes, it's like Elaine and George being left to speak, and it's like suddenly, yes, what do we talk about? We talk about Jerry. So yep. Yes. Oh, now that is intriguing. I mean, it also does serve the plot because Big John is separating John B from his friends, not only physically, but also by this interdiction on telling them what's actually going on. And that is one of the rules, apart from no Pogue on Pogue action, that the Pogues never lie to each other, and also no Pogue left behind. They have quite a few rules.
Yes.
But lying, they're not allowed to do that.
Yes, definitely not. Despite the fact that John B and Sarah are at the very least fake married, supposedly.
Well, John B tells Big John on the boat trip back to the Outer Banks, "I'm married now," he says quite boldly.
Yes, yes. I remember them being fake married, and then I think they fake divorced, so I don't remember.
Don't quite know where they are.
Yeah, I don't know where they are. All right. Well, that was another interesting two episodes, but I'm excited to see what comes next. I feel like we're back in the Outer Banks. We've got some interesting happenings with the cross. So I can't help but notice how funny it is to have the cross be in the Outer Banks, travel all the way to Guadeloupe just to go back to the Outer Banks. It's a little funny. It's a little convenient.
I hope they're packing it well.
Yes. Very, very convenient that the timeline of how long the kids were on the deserted island is also the exact timeline of how long Ward was in a coma. It's just really convenient.
Yes. Perhaps he sensed a movement in the force when they got off the island.
Mm. Perhaps. All right.
Yeah.
All
so right. I think a lot of table setting in these two episodes. I didn't mind them, but I felt like, okay, we're getting a whole lot of pieces in the right place. And then hopefully we're going to go back to our breakneck speed to come.
I think so. All right. Well, everyone, thanks for listening, and consider becoming a Post Show Recaps patron if you enjoyed the content provided today. Get access to early access to podcasts as well as patron exclusive podcasts. Any level gets you access to the patron only Discord, and there's a lot of fun conversations there. Merch is also available at higher levels. And if you are just interested in merch, you can also head over to the postshowrecaps.com store as well. And if you would like to become a patron, sign up at patreon.com/postshowrecaps or postshowrecaps.com/patreon. As well, if you would like to follow Sarah or myself, you can do that as well. Sarah, what sort of things do you have going on, and where can people find you?
Well, people can find me if they want to at Sarah Carradine on Twitter. I host a weekly true crime review podcast called Crime Scene, S-E-E-N, on RHAP, Reality TV Rehab Ups. I'm writing about Australian Survivor, Heroes versus Villains, every week in Inside Survivor. And on Silent Podcasts, I'm talking all things Taskmaster Australia. And what about you, Mary?
You can follow me everywhere at Frail Mary to keep up with my various podcasts and other adventures.
Sensible adventures with laced up
shoes. Sensible adventures. Yes, I'm currently trying to rework my personal website that I've converted into a running blog. So if you're interested in sensible adventures that come prepared with things like you said, laced up shoes, spare jackets, and running fuel. You can follow me on Twitter for info about that, because the website's not complete yet, but I'll let you know when that comes out. So just yay, you have to follow me to stay updated on these things. All right, until next time, until death do us part.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.